Only an idiot would say that. That's what I have to say. It's really nonsense to say that DNA could inherently form with a functioning code. Things don't happen like that any more than you can take a random box of letters, shake it together, dump it on the ground, and have a written book. You might occasionally find a three-letter word, but it's not next then to another intelligible word where you're going to form a book out of this thing. And remember, even if you had three or four words in a string that happened to form, it's not going to make any sense. There's nothing on either side of that. You need lots of information. Nobody in their right mind even says this, except people who know nothing about the field.
Today, we're honored to welcome one of the world's leading scientists boldly challenging the prevailing theories on the origin of life, Dr. James Tour. Dr. Tour is a world-renowned synthetic organic chemist and nanotechnologist. He serves as the TT and WF Cal Professor of Chemistry, Professor of Computer Science, and Professor of Materials Science and Nanoengineering at Rice University in Houston, Texas. With over 750 research publications and more than 140 patents, Dr. Tour has been named among the top 10 most influential chemists in the world over the past decade. Now, his pioneering work spans from nanotechnology and molecular electronics to medicine and advanced materials. But beyond his groundbreaking scientific contributions, Dr. Tour is also widely recognized for his thoughtful engagement on questions of faith, science, and the origin of life itself. Dr. Tour, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Absolutely. It's an honor to have you here today to discuss these things. So we believe that we're in the age of design, a scientific renaissance of knowledge in discovering the complexity of life systems. So what do you think has been the most significant discovery to challenge the current or the older origin of life theories that we've been taught for several generations?
Wow, there are so many. Previously, it was thought there was a pond and some small molecules and some lightning strikes, and those molecules became more complex molecules. And then they assembled into a higher order structure, namely a cell. And then those cells started to come together and form multicellular organisms. And you then got these creatures in the pond that would then come out of the pond, and that's how the origin of life. Every step that I just told you has been shown to be nonsense. None of that happens. And so every step along the way, there's been nonsense. And the complexity of the cell has gone up dramatically, even since the Miller-Urey experiment, which was in 1953, where they made amino acids were made in a high-voltage environment. The DNA was just announced that year. They didn't even know about DNA prior to that. So the cell has gotten much more complex, even the simplest of cells. So there's so much structure there, and we have no idea how that could have formed in a prebiotic soup. So everything, and every new discovery of the cell increases the complexity. So we actually get further away from the target every year.
That's extremely interesting, because post-1931, there's been this renaissance in molecular and cellular research, and it's been shaping our scientific understanding of life's complexity, but at the same time, almost has been suppressed because of pre-existing thoughts on the origin of life. Can you talk about that for just a little bit?
Yes, the pre-existing thought is what many of us were taught when we were in school, that this primordial soup. And what's happening now is you see some backtracking of scientists claiming, well, we don't really teach that anymore. They absolutely do. Not only is it taught in elementary schools, it's taught throughout grade school, and it's taught in college, and it's taught in advanced college that way. There are advanced textbooks in biology that will still talk about this primordial soup model, or this smelly pond model, or they'll mention a hydrothermal vent in an ocean. None of that produces the molecules that are needed for life. This is the prevailing model. And then as soon as you start looking at every one of those steps that you would need, of which there are thousands and thousands of steps, every one of them breaks down. And none of them has been reproduced in a prebiotically relevant way to make a product that itself would be relevant along this course to build a living system.
Well, the age of design presents our time as this new era of revelation, not mystery. And yet origin of life theories remain pretty weak in explanatory power and evidence. Why do you think these previous theories continue to fall behind in modern scientific discovery?
Well, I think that, as Richard Feynman, a great Nobel Prize winning physicist, said, that the easiest person for you to deceive in the sciences, the easiest person to deceive is yourself. You start looking at a problem and you want to find a solution, and you think that the result that you got suggests a solution. Whereas in this case, every result that is gotten in Origin of Life studies screams out that this is how life could not have happened. The product it's giving you is telling you that life didn't happen that way. And so I think that people are deceived, and then they encourage each other. They publish these papers and they make these bold claims. But then as soon as you stand back and look at it, you see that the emperor has no clothes. There's lots of things here that are just utterly not working.
So Dr. Tour, science has now revealed that, you know, what Charles Darwin, when he had these primitive microscopes, he's looking at a simple cell, and he would indeed have thought that it was probably pretty simple. But now we're seeing that, you know, even a single cell is intricately organized. So can you talk a little bit about what are the essential components that makes life as it is possible?
Right. So I'm not sure how much Darwin really dealt with the origin of life. He himself said the origin of life is a mystery. He dealt predominantly with evolution, whereas you say, all right, I've already have the first cell. How does that first cell transform into multicellular organisms and then higher organisms from that? That's what he was primarily dealing with. He didn't deal with the origin of life. He didn't know what the components were that were necessary for life. Right now, we know that. We know what components are necessary. You need four major classes of compounds. You need the lipids, which form the bilayer, a lipid bilayer around every cell. This is like the sac that things are contained in. But it's not a very simple structure. It's actually quite a complex structure. And then the pieces in the cell is you need to have polypeptides, which is the structure of all of our proteins and our enzymes, enzymes being the little nanomachines that build us. And then you have to have the sugars, which are sometimes called saccharides, and the polymerization product of those are the polysaccharides. So you have to have the polysaccharides. And those polysaccharides are components on our cell surface, components within the cell. There are energy sources. And then you have to have the nucleotides. The nucleotides are the DNA and the RNA. And nucleotides have three different component parts. They have a sugar unit, so you have to solve the sugar problem before you can make DNA and RNA. And then they have a phosphate group attached, and then they have a nucleobase, something that's a basic structure that is going to allow the base pairing within the double helical structure where these things are stabilized. So all of those structures are made of simpler structures. So the polynucleotides are made of the nucleotides. We don't know how to make the components of the nucleotides and have those assemble into a nucleotide, and then have those polymerize into the polynucleotides or the DNA and RNA. Every one of those steps we don't know. We don't know how the lipids were made, the small molecules, the lipids that make up the bilayer. And then once you have the lipids, it's difficult, not impossible, but it's difficult to make a lipid bilayer. But a lipid bilayer by itself will not work. You have to have these transmembrane proteins. You have to have ion channels in order for this to respirate, in order to have breathing to occur. These ion channels are made up of very complex molecules. The proteins, you have to have not just the amino acids, you have to be able to polymerize the amino acids. Nobody's ever polymerized the amino acids in a clean form above something like a 14 mer. Nobody's ever been able to do it because these things don't just polymerize. Every one of these polymeric forms has something called a free energy that's positive. A free energy that's positive means that they're not spontaneous reactions. They don't go by themselves. So they have to have special chemical activation. And then the hardest problem is actually the sugars. Making the sugars, we don't know how the sugars would be made. And some of the prevailing views of how those sugars have been made have come crashing down just this year in 2025, in April of 2025. The papers are coming out on that, that we don't know how to make the sugars. And then once you have the sugars, we don't know how to polymerize those into the polysaccharides. So in all of those cases, we're lost. So we're lost on all the basic building blocks of the building blocks, and then we're lost on all the building blocks, which are the four polymerization products of those. And so we can't even get started on life. Now, once you have all those, then there's a lot of higher order structures that you have to have in order to have a cell structure. And those higher order structures are often through non-covalent bonds, just the molecular interactions that are not hooking molecules together directly, but are stabilizing them through things called van der Waals interactions, which compose of hydrophilic and hydrophobic interactions. We don't know how those got assembled. The magnitude of the problem, the statistical problem in overcoming any of these is astronomical. Way more time would be needed to do this, way more time than in any universe to allow this to happen. So every one of these is a barrier. So it doesn't look like we have any good solutions to this from a materialistic standpoint.
Okay, so what you're saying is that the goalpost is being moved farther and farther away for a naturalistic origin of life.
Absolutely. So in 1953, you could think that, hey, the cell is just a bunch of protoplasm in there. There's not much to it. Certainly in the 1930s, that's what you would think. But now the target has gotten much harder. So even though somebody may say, well, hey, we've gotten closer, the goalpost has moved much further away, and it keeps moving further away every year. And this is the way we track progress in science. We say, okay, how much closer are we to a solution now that we've gotten this information? And so then if you try to track that every year, it turns out that you end up further away from a solution every year because the target, the cell, has moved further away. Not that the cell has evolved any differently. It's just that now we understand more of the structure necessary within a cell, so the target's moved further away.
Yeah. Dr. Tour, you mentioned that, if we go back to 1930, if we go to 1950, how has the sequencing of DNA, which is a much more recent advancement, changed this entire discussion?
Well, in 1953, the structure of DNA was determined, but that didn't tell us how DNA really codes for the enzymes that are going to be needed. That came a few years later on three letters designate a particular amino acid in a protein sequence. And so that's when we learn that. And then there's many surrounding mechanisms that allow the assembly of these little enzymes. But just having that structure doesn't do anything because you have to have the code. So without the code, in other words, just if you have a computer code with ones and zeros, until those are put in a logical sequence that will code for something, nothing's going to run. So inherent in the DNA is not just a random box of letters. So if you just take a random box of letters and shake it up, you don't get a book. I mean, there's nothing you can read. You have to have the coded structure to put that into words. And those words then have to go into sentences in order to have the structure. We don't know how those words were put together. We don't know how those sentences were put together. That's where we are, and so we remain clueless on that. With all our advances on DNA, we remain clueless.
And that's incredible, and that's honest, right? A lot of times things are just thrown out there within the scientific community, and theories, suggestions, ideas are even perpetrated as fact. But to say, hey, we don't know this, that's what science is all about. And what it also means is that there's room for expansion, there's room for growth as we learn more.
Yes, there's room for research, and so I'm very big on research. We have to continue to do it. But also, I'm practical. So we've been doing research for almost 75 years now, and since the Miller-Urey experiment in 1953, and since the structure of DNA. And we're no closer, but we're actually further away from figuring out life's origin. So we have to change the direction in which we're going, because we're fast falling further away from the target. So I think there's real changes in the way we approach this problem that have to be done. And there is some confession that has to be put out that what we've been doing is just not working.
Yeah. I'm going to get very specific here and see what you have to say. Here's a question. What is life?
So science doesn't tell us what is life. Science tells us the characteristics of life. So the primary unit in life is a cell. And if you look at a cell, it has to have certain features. And one of the things that it does, it has to have a metabolism so that it can get chemical energy and go forward with its life. It has to be able to breathe. It has to be able to respirate. It has to be able to pass on traits to offspring. So it has to be able to have offspring and carry on it, pass on its traits to its offspring. It has to have homeostasis, which is a general operating system running it that allows it to operate. These are characteristics of life. That is not what life is. Science does not define for us what life is. Those are the characteristics. So what we're really going toward in the lab is a functioning unit that has those characteristics of life. But what life is probably something that is better explained to us by the Bible than by science.
That's extremely interesting. So we don't know exactly, we can't define by science what life is. What do you think is that spark, that energy, that force activating life? Do you think that can be found by going back to biblical accounts?
Well, certainly the Bible tells us that we've been made in the image of God, that God created all things. So in that, we can understand the source of all this is God. But there's not any detail, really, in the book of Genesis that tells us the details of how this happened. Yes, he breathed life into Adam, made him a living being. But what's the details of that? How did the cells start operating? There's classically been something called this vital force that people thought there was behind life. We really don't know, but it would be very hard to imagine that if you just had all the molecules in the right place, the thing would start operating. Because if that were the case, you'd think you could take a cell that has just died and bring it back to life, and it can't be done. We don't know how to do that. So whatever is moving this from a non-living to a living structure, we haven't identified.
Dr. Tour, you just mentioned something that is incredibly profound. I don't know if we all actually think about that, but you're saying if we have a fully intact, dead, single cell, we've got all of the elements necessary for life. In fact, it was just living, but we can't actually bring that back to life.
That is correct. So you would think that bringing a dead cell back to life would be much easier than creating life de novo from a new form. It's the same in any way. A resurrection should be easier than creating the whole structure from the beginning, from the elements of carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, and phosphorus, and sulfur. So these are the elements that make us up, and we have a little bit of inorganics. We have iron and zinc and a little bit of selenium. But you would think that it'd be easier to take a dead structure and bring it back to life because things are pretty much in place. We've never been able to solve that one either. So that's how far we are from this. And we have no idea what it is, what's needed to get it going again so that it starts showing the characteristics of life.
You know, a lot of chemists don't even attempt to tackle the origin of life, but origin of life scientists, those who are studying this issue, how in the world, based on what we've learned just in the last few moments, how do they suggest to bring a concoction of random assembled parts to life?
Well, what they suggest is that if you pull all of these elements together, these four classes of molecules together, that somehow they will start operating together in a life-moving form. And that's never been the case. There's no calculations that suggest that to be the case. In fact, there's calculations of order, of protein folding, of interactome arrangement that argue against that ever happening. There's not enough time in our universe. There's not enough time in a billion, billion, billion universes to be able to make that happening. So statistically, everything's against us. Chemically, everything's against us. And we have no idea how that happens. There's silliness that people are looking at a Marangoni effect of how lipid bilayers might move around in solution, suggesting that is some sort of precursor to life. It is not a precursor to life, not by anyone's definition, except the researcher who's deceiving him or herself. That's how far we are. We're very far from life.
You know, maybe this is a bit strong, but in textbooks, in scientific textbooks, in college biology textbooks, in so many things today, there are deceptions, there are inaccuracies, and if I could be even so bold, lies found in those textbooks. Can you tell me about a few of these things that are being taught within the scientific community and to college students?
Yeah, I mean this happens all the time. Now, I want to say that I don't think any scientists begin writing a textbook and saying, "Let me lie about this." There's no intent to lie outright, but there are speculations. There are hypotheses that are put forth as fact, and that's highly inaccurate. There are facts within the sciences. Water is H2O, two hydrogens and an oxygen. You may have different isotopes where you vary the number of neutrons, but it's still two hydrogens and an oxygen. That's water. That's a fact that doesn't change. Then there are hypotheses, and people will put forth example, they'll put forth things in the origin of life as a hypothesis on how life might have formed, but that is not a fact. And the hypothesis is so weak because it's never been demonstrated. Not only would it not work on an early Earth, you can't even get it to work in your own laboratory. So the hypothesis has no basis. What you do is you're supposed to test hypotheses and see if they could be valid. So there are you're probably better off not even calling it a hypothesis. There are just so stories that are put forth, and they are projected as if they're fact. And then based on that, it appears that it might be a lie, but there was no intent to make it a lie. But that's how far away we are from an answer. And that happens all the time, not just in origin of life. That happens in evolutionary models as well. There's many pieces of evolution that how you go from an invertebrate to a vertebrate and how you get that many transformations in a DNA that would be that would have to occur at the same time in the same place to have a transition like that. Nobody knows how that could happen. But it's put forth as if small changes all of a sudden result in a spine to be grown. That's not the case at all. So I don't think there's an intent to lie, but when you start calling hypotheses or just so stories facts, then therein lies the problem.
So based on this, and also based on scholars such as yourself learning these new things, these new groundbreaking things that we're discovering within the scientific community. How would you suggest we go about trying to recondition the textbooks? How would you suggest we go about trying to get some of these inaccuracies and lies out of what is being taught to the next generation of scientists who will then continue to perpetuate the myth just because they trusted what was written?
Yeah, I think you have to get rid of the just-so stories and look at them as things of the past, as relics. People used to suggest X, Y, and Z. We now know that there is no credible evidence that suggests that that hypothesis could be sound. So that the students see that there was a historical progression on how things might have occurred. Just like we put forth historical evidence that we say that the universe always used to be. That was the prevailing view among scientists through the 1950s, that the universe never had a beginning. And then with the discovery of microwave background radiation in 1963, everything changed, that the universe has a beginning, that the vast majority of scientists saw that data, saw the expanding universe, and it suggested that, yes, the universe had an origin point, very much actually similar to what the Bible suggests, that there was an origin to our universe. So we still teach the steady state hypothesis, saying this is what people used to believe. They used to believe that the universe never had an origin, it just always was. Now the suggestion is it had an origin point. And so we can still teach the old methods, but we say we know from newer evidence that this is not the case and that those very hypotheses do not work. So that students understand this is a very fresh area for research, that we really are clueless on these things, and so let's do some research. And there are ways to do this even within the origin of life research. So for origin of life research, you could say, okay, well, I have this cell. It has just died. What might I be able to do to bring it back to life? That would be probably something that would be more fruitful. Or to take a cell and to knock out different parts of it and see where it stops operating, and you bring it just to the verge where it's going to stop operating and see if you can put things back in to get it to operate again. And there have been experiments like this. And there have been experiments where they've knocked out lots of genes and the cell can do many functions, but it can no longer reproduce, for example. And then they'll put the genes back in and it'll start bringing in those functions. So these are experiments that I think are probably a direction to go, where you start with life and you start modifying it, say in a cell, and then bringing it back and things like this. That would be a better way to go. But I think that's how you can correct textbooks, saying this is what we used to think. Now we know this newer data suggests that those hypotheses don't work. So we're really clueless on life's origin, and we're clueless on many phases of the neo-Darwinian model, or the Darwinian or newer Darwinian models. There's a lot of gaps there that we'd have to be able to fill in. And there's other ways to look at the same data. And I've covered some of that with my colleague Rob Statler on my YouTube channel, Dr. James Tour, where we've gone through that. So rather than having this tree of life, you look at a little bit different model that actually matches up better with the scientific data and is much more in line actually with what is suggested in the Bible.
So we want to take a break here in a second, but one final question, and that is, when it comes to origin of life researchers, when it comes to scientists in the modern day who are studying these things, are there deceptions involved based on the worldview, the way that people are looking at this? Or is it simply completely blinded because of peer pressure and academic pressure, and this is what my professor taught me, so therefore I have to parrot it?
I don't think that there's an active deception. I don't think that they're going into their science and saying, let me see what I can deceive the world with today. I think that there's they have been deceived, but it's more delusion. looking at their own data. They're not looking at it in a way that tells us how this screams out, it didn't happen this way. So I think that they're deluding themselves, and the community is deluding itself as well. So that you have other people around you saying, oh yeah, yeah, it could have been that. And then they surround it with just so stories. Not even good hypotheses, but just fanciful, imaginative stories. And I think that that's what's going on in the community around origin of life. And whatever the scientists say in their papers with their just so stories, the press then ratchets it up tenfold. And they come out with crazy statements like, scientists have finally figured out how life began. If you do not believe in the physical resurrection of Jesus Christ, send me an email, tour@drjamestour.org, and we will get together and I will share with you about why I embrace the resurrection of Jesus.
Okay, let's talk about nucleotide formation for a second, because you've said that there is no plausible prebiotic pathway for forming nucleotides through naturalistic ways. Why is it so difficult for these things, the building blocks of DNA, to form naturally under prebiotic conditions?
Well, to have DNA or RNA, you first have to solve the sugar problem. So you have to be able to make sugars. Sugars are very hard to make. There's a reaction called the Formose reaction, which was presumed to be the mechanism by which these would form. But the Formose reaction does not give us the sugars that we need in any type of quantity that we're going to need to make DNA or RNA. That's the problem. And then once you've made these things that actually we've not figured out how to make them in a prebiotically relevant manner, these particular sugars, how you attach the nitrogenous base is very hard. Some of them a little bit easier than others, but it's a difficult problem on how to get that attached. And then you've got to somehow get the phosphate attached. All of those are very hard problems. And people have tried to do that, and with lots and lots of very careful things in the lab, trying to mimic prebiotic conditions, they've been able to get simple little things that don't work very well. And that's, again, starting with known sugars that they've gotten from natural sources, not from a prebiotic method, because the sugar problem's not been solved. So that's what we're up against. But then you try to polymerize these together. So there's a hypothesis saying that RNA is the model of what forms. So if you think about RNA, the RNA can polymerize in two different ways. It can do what's called a three prime, five prime polymerization, which tells you which hydroxyl is going to add to the next one. And that's the order that you want. There's another way. It's the 2'5' method, and that would give you something that does not work. Plus, there's an extra hydroxyl on RNA that allows side branching. So every time you try to make, even if you start with a pure nucleotide that you could never get, because nobody's made a chiral sugar like this. Even if you took it from a natural system, and now you just tried to polymerize this, whether it be on montmorillonite clay, or it be on some glass surface, some boron glass surface, all of these always give branching, large degrees of branching, and large amounts of the 2,5 linkage. So it could not have worked. So we can't get these structured right. We don't know how to put them together. But even if we knew how to put them together, they would have a random assembly order. It would be like taking a box of letters and shaking it up. You do not get words that way. You get randomness that doesn't make any sense. So you have to have had the code that allows these to set up in the right way, because it is this code that will prescribe the order of the arrangements of the amino acids on a polypeptide, and that is going to control how that polypeptide constructs other molecules. So if you don't have the code, none of this can work, and we have no idea for the origin of the code.
So the origin of the code, because it's almost like an information language system.
Yeah, yeah. And without the code, without somebody taking those box of letters and putting them in the right order, you just have a string of nonsense there. It doesn't make any sense. And so if you could put like little Velcro ends on the ends of these so that they would assemble and stick together, you don't get real words. You get a bunch of nonsense that doesn't make any sense. You have to have an operator giving informational input to say, here, put this one, this one, this one. Now you have a word. And now put this one, this one, this one. Now you have a word. And in biology, three letters make up words all the time. Three letters make up words. And you can do this with these four different bases. You can make three-letter words, and you have 20 what are called canonical amino acids. And these will code for specific amino acids. And some amino acids could be coded by a few different words, just like we have synonyms. Well, a synonym would be a word that has these multiple meanings. But here you can have two different types of words having exactly the same meaning. But this is inherent in there. There's this informational code, and you've got to be able to deal with this, and nobody knows where the information came from. So even if you could assemble these, it'd just be a box of random letters that makes no sense.
Okay, but let's just say, and Dr. Tour, you mentioned, I love that analogy of putting Velcro on the back of letters and then seeing what sticks together. Does it form words? Well, it's going to have a randomness to it. Is there any way to say that, well, somehow if you get a few of those random things that do actually form words, well, then it's going to be robust enough to then reproduce and carry that on? Or is that really not possible based on a naturalistic model?
Yeah, statistically, it's impossible. It's just like saying that you're going to take these random letters and you're going to get a book out of it. Because you have to put many, many words together in order to get a functional protein. So if you want to have, say, a 200-mer functional amino acid sequence in an enzyme, you're going to have at least 600-plus letters in a prescribed order. That's very hard to do. Take 600 letters and shake it up and get something useful out of that. Yeah, you might you get randomness, but you don't get something useful out of that. That's the problem. So none of this is going to work. And the other thing is, you say, well, what if we wait a long time and it just keeps making things? Aren't we going to, once in a while, it's going to form something useful? Well, actually, the answer is no, because these oligonucleotides, which have to prescribe for this RNA, which has to prescribe for this, has a very short lifetime, something on the order of minutes. So if you had a 600-mer, it would last a few minutes in water. And that's under pristine conditions. If you had some magnesium ions floating around, it'd be even less time than that. And people don't understand this, so let me make it clear that we're not talking about having an RNA molecule and having a mole of them. This is when you have one RNA molecule. So you may have RNA that you say is still functioning after 6 months in water. Well, a lot of it would have decomposed, but you no longer have a half-life when you're talking about one molecule. You have to convert that to a probability. When that's converted to a probability, they don't stick around. So no, you don't have long periods of time. These molecules are extremely sensitive and they start falling apart. And even the polypeptide that formed, say a part of it formed and it's waiting for the other part to form, that only has a matter of several days and it starts hydrolyzing in water. So just the water itself does this. So it's a big problem, and all of these lead to more mysteries.
Okay, so this is super interesting because you just mentioned a couple of issues that would be there, but don't most origin of life models, no matter which one you go with, whether it's a watery basis or a hot, warm, soupy structure or a lot of sunlight or temperature swings, don't those all play a part in most origin of life models? And then wouldn't those actually destroy those fragile components you were talking about?
Yeah, they all play a part and they all destroy the fragile parts. That's exactly it. And this is the self-delusion that I'm talking about, the self-deception. All these models where you say it was hot cold cycles, these hot cycles that would decompose it, the hydrothermal vents that decomposes it. So all of these conditions that people like to think of, it results in their faster decomposition. But none of those addresses the code. I thought you were going to ask me, don't all of these models somehow within them address the code formation? And my answer to that would be no, none of them address the code. And you say, well, how do the researchers handle this code problem so that you have some intelligible words that would come out of this? The way they handle this problem is they don't. They totally avoid it. None of the models address this code problem. And so that's the other problem. And so you know, there's this elephant in the room, and everybody wants to act like the elephant doesn't exist.
Okay, all right. So I want to get to a couple of other things here. And this is incredibly interesting. But there was a recent scientific report in Nature Communications. It detailed space rocks that fell to Earth within the last century and contained five bases, you know, ATCG. Is that significant? And would those bases ever naturally join up with, let's just say, a phosphate and a sugar to form a nucleotide?
No, you don't get those. And if on occasion you find a nucleotide by randomness, you might find a very, very small amount mixed in with trillions and trillions and trillions of other molecules. So therefore, it becomes unusable. You can take a fistful of supplements in the morning, and your body knows what to do with each one of those supplements because now you have enzymes to segregate those. That is not the case with chemistry. Before you have a biological system, there are no enzymes to do these segregations. And so when you have mixtures of compounds, those absolutely do not work. You can't redeem it. These are totally unusable. You have to get them separated. And we have many techniques that we've developed over a period of 100 years within organic chemistry to try to separate and purify compounds. And then there's occasions when the compounds are what are called diastereomers or enantiomers, where it gets so hard, it's impractical to be able to separate these, especially when you have large numbers of mixtures. So whatever has come in on a meteorite is unusable. I recently interviewed Ed Peltzer on my YouTube channel. Ed worked for Stanley Miller of the Miller-Urey reaction. And his boss, Jeffrey Beta, had gotten his PhD with Stanley Miller. Ed Peltzer worked for Beta, but he also interacted with Stanley Miller himself. He was an expert in analyzing these meteorites that would come in and have these molecules on them. And he was an expert in this. And he said, they're totally unusable. They're not usable. And you never see the chirality. You never see the pure mixtures to be able to deal with these. And so even he confessed that these are unusable. Anything that has ever been delivered on a meteorite is unusable, even in our modern laboratory, let alone on an early Earth.
Wow. Okay. All right. I've got one more question before we take another quick break, because we're learning a whole lot. And then again, as a layman, we'll go through these websites and we'll see these incredible headlines that just seem so fantastic, and it seems like everything is figured out and from a naturalistic perspective. But then when you start to dig into it, you start finding these problems that, Dr. Tour, you've been bringing up time and time again. But one of the things that has consistently been an issue with origin of life models is chirality, or handedness, basically, right? Can you explain chirality? Can you explain right-handed versus left-handed structures and amino acids, and why is it important?
Yes, the vast majority of biological molecules, in order to have life, you have to have biological type molecules that have a handedness. And you can look at it as your left and your right hand. The two hands are mirror images of one another. So in other words, if I put my right hand up to a mirror, what I would see is an image of it that would look like a left hand. So just hold your hand up to a mirror, and in that mirror, you are going to see what looks like somebody holding up their left hand. That's what it's going to look like. So these are called mirror images, and they're non-superimposable, meaning that that's why you cannot put your right hand into a left-handed glove. It doesn't work. And the vast majority of organic molecules are like that. And so every lipid is like that. Every polypeptide is like that. Every nuclear base is like that. And every sugar is like that. And it's more than, in many of these molecules, it's more than just one element of chirality. It could be multiple elements of chirality can be wrong. So that's what we're talking about. And that's what's going on here. And that's one of the problems of what's going on. Now you have to solve that problem. How do you solve that problem? Nobody knows how that problem was solved on an early Earth. We have machines that can pull these things apart, but those are elaborate machines that have already put chiral elements in there. So it's a big problem. It remains a big problem. And you couldn't have had life until you solve that problem.
And might I mention, machines created by an intelligence. Do you think that all of these hurdles that we've talked about so far, all of these issues, do you think that things are pointing more strongly to design or to a chemical chance process?
It's certainly not a chemical chance process. So it would look more toward a design process. I don't have a tool in my lab that tells me, is this a design system? So I generally don't speak in those terms, but it certainly looks like there's no random process that's going to get us there. Nothing that we know of. Because of you, millions of people have heard the gospel.
If you confess with your mouth Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that he's risen from the dead, and you will be saved.
That's right.
That's the requirement.
We talk about science concepts which draw people in.
Take these nanomachines and have them drill into cells.
This would be a great way to kill cancer, right? We also talk about Jesus Christ, who's the best in everything.
My faith in Jesus Christ means more to me than anything.
If you could continue to give or give for the first time, we would certainly appreciate it. You can go to jesusandscience.org/donate. All U.S. donations are tax deductible. Thank you so much.
Dr. Tour, what do you mean when you say that even the building blocks of the building blocks haven't been made?
All right, so the building blocks are the four classes of compounds, the polymeric structures of the compounds that you've just outlined. So to have proteins, you have to first have amino acids. So you have to be able to make 20 different amino acids and have them all chiral, all handed. Of the 20, 19 of them have to be chiral. So one of them doesn't have a chiral center, doesn't have a stereogenic center. So all of them have to have an anti-purity, 19 of the 20. So those are the building blocks of the building blocks. If you want to make polysaccharides, the sugars, the polysaccharide molecules, you have to be able to make first the basic sugars before you can hook them together in the polysaccharide. Before you can make a polynucleic acid, DNA or RNA, you have to have the nucleic acid, which has to be solved. And in order to make a lipid, you have to have a glycerol and a fatty acid and a glycerol. And we don't know how to get those fatty acids pure. We don't know how to get a stereogenic center on the fatty acids. And we don't know how to distinguish what's called the enantiotopic ends of a glycerol to get these things to be chiral. So we don't even know how to make the tiny pieces that make up those four classes of molecules.
Wow. Okay. So what do you think is if you had to pick one, the toughest chemical challenge that we currently have in Origin of Life research?
Well, there's many of them, but one of the tough ones is the synthesis of the sugars and hooking them together. How do you hook the sugars together? So if you just have six glucose molecules, you have to, there's 1.2 trillion ways you can hook together just six. So when you have hundreds of them hooked together and they have to be hooked together in the right order or the cell doesn't function, that's a real problem. How do you do that? So that's, again, just one of many. It's hard to distinguish which one is harder than the other because every one of them is hard.
Right. When you have these overwhelming obstacles and you could just pick one, and I mean, you could talk about it forever on any one of those obstacles that have to be leaped in order to solve this problem from a natural perspective. But then again, we see these headlines, we see them on the news, we see them on the science websites, we pick up a magazine and we're flipping through it, and it's like, oh, we figured all of this out. Why do you think that progress in this particular field is often overstated in general media?
That's an interesting question. It is highly overstated. And the researchers know that it's highly overstated. They know they're not just on the verge of figuring this thing out. I am not sure why they keep saying this. Is it because they think they have to say this in order to keep their grants flowing, in order to get money? I don't know. Is it something more philosophical, something deeper here, that we have to suggest that we know the origin of life and we know that it has this materialistic bent to it, so that we can somehow exclude some higher being that has done this? I don't know why they permit this to go on, that they're just on the verge of this, but I can tell you that they keep dying of old age without ever having solved this. So decade after decade, they keep saying they're very close, and they keep dying. And they're going to continue to die of old age before they ever solve this problem. And then the next generation will say they're just on the verge, and they'll die too, and the next generation after that, because we're that far away from this.
You know, Dr. Tour, I think that's a great point. And as a Christian, I read something like 1 Samuel 2 that says that the Lord brings death and makes alive. He can make people alive. He brings down to the grave and he raises us up. And so when I see that there is, I believe that there's a divine being that created us all with purpose, that we are wonderfully made, that we're made in his image. And that puts an entirely different meaning to life and the origin of life issue and how we can fully understand it. But when it comes to the different processes, the different classes that life depends on, I want to get your opinion on a couple of these. Let's talk about carbohydrates for a moment, the molecules expected to provide both energy and structural support. And this is where chemistry gets real. This is way beyond a lot of things that I might even be able to comprehend. Sugars like ribose struggle with instability in water, messy mixtures, unhelpful side reactions. I want to step into carbohydrates for a moment and see why even the very first rung on this ladder of the natural origin of life is so, so hard to climb. So talk about carbohydrates for a moment and explain on a layman's level how we can understand these things and what the issues are if we are trying to answer this question.
Well, carbohydrates to sugar is the very problem I was just talking about. What happens is carbohydrates will have multiple sites where there's what's called a chiral or stereogenic center. These can all have a hand in this, every one of these centers. And so since you have so many of them, you can have five centers, or you can have four centers, depending on which particular carbohydrate you're talking about. And so you get vast mixtures, because you get on the ones that have five centers, you have 2^5 possible isomers, and the ones that have four, you have 2^4 centers. The ones that have three, you have 2^3 possible centers. So you might have 8 possible isomers, and these compound the problem because you have so many different possible isomers, meaning that they're similar in structure, but they're not the same, and only one of those is going to work. And if you have mixtures of them, that gums up the work and it doesn't function. The other thing is, how are these two going to hook together? Say, I can hook thumbs to thumbs. I can hook thumb to forefinger, thumb to middle finger, thumb to ring finger, thumb to pinky finger. So there's all these different combinations. And then on the next molecule that it hooks to, again, are all these combinations. That compounds the problem of how you hook these things together. Number one, what is the chemistry that you use to hook them together? Nobody knows what the chemistry is on a prebiotic earth, because this is where I talk about the free energy is positive. They favor not being together. They don't want to be together. So how do you get them to hook together? Well, in nature, you use enzymes. In the lab, we have these clever techniques that we've figured out. But even with our clever techniques, it's very hard to hook the right one to the right. And so what we do is we block all the other sites and we just hook to the ones that we want to. It's a lot of laborious chemistry. Big, big problem to solve that. And then we can't hook them together. So we can't make these little things without getting vast mixtures, and we can't hook them together without getting vast mixtures. So this is the genesis of the problem with carbohydrates. It is the most difficult class of compounds. Plus carbohydrates can have a hydroxyl group on the end, which is called the enomeric center, can be up or down. If it's in one configuration, people can, for example, eat it, and you're eating some carbohydrate that you can digest, for example, wheat. But if you have the other configuration, then it's a carbohydrate that we can't eat. That's grass, for example. Our bodies cannot digest that. And that's just a little varying of the hydroxyl group going up or down. Depends on whether we can even use it for food, let alone use it for other biological functions. So this is the problem. If we eat grass, for example, it goes right through us. It's called fiber. It goes right through us, but our body doesn't get any content to be able to live off of from that. It might be good for our digestive system, but it's not good for much else in giving us energy. So that's the inherent problem with carbohydrates. That's just one of the four classes of compounds that if you don't get it right, it doesn't work. And it's not like you can mess around with this thing. This has to be right. None of these problems have been solved with carbohydrates.
And again, I love it, Dr. Tour, where you mention the complexity of all of this. And if you get the chirality of something wrong, it doesn't work. If you flip it on its head, it doesn't work. If it doesn't connect up, or if it creates a mixture instead of the exact right thing, it doesn't work. Again, we understand this now within chemistry, but nature doesn't have a mind. Nature can't possibly comprehend all of this, and somehow will it into existence. So even if we could clear the sugar hurdles, life still needs workers, right? That means protein. So let's move for a moment from energy and scaffolding to the active machinery inside the cell. Proteins are a sequence of amino acids. You mentioned that we see, 20 standard types that need to be specifically arranged and then folded into chains, sometimes 500 amino acids, right? But these chains are also working with other chains to form enzymes or molecular machines with sometimes thousands, 5, 6, 7,000 of these amino acids put together. And a lot of original life experiments claim that amino acids can simply form under prebiotic conditions. What do you see as the major challenges with those claims?
Right. So if you use the Miller-Urey experiment, that made about, I don't know, 12 or so, 13 or so of the amino acids, of the canonical amino acids that you need of the 20. But what it did is it took the simplest of the amino acids, glycine, and it made a very large amount of that. And then it took the next simplest and it made a lot of that, to the exclusion of all the others. And you can't get a functioning enzyme that's made predominantly out of these, this simplest glycine, and these would dominate. The other problem here is that these amino acids react with the carbohydrates. So you had to have kept the carbohydrates far away from this, because they would react with what's called the reducing sugar. All of these carbohydrates have reducing sugars. They have an aldehyde on the end. And these amino acids have an amine. That's why they're called amino acids. And those amines will form what's called an imine with a carbohydrate. And then you get dehydration and you get this Millard reaction and you get this decomposition and everything starts forming these polymers, which are unusable. So in any origin of life scenario, you have to say, well, somehow I'm going to make my amino acids and keep them totally away from other molecule classes where there's a carbohydrate. And how do you do that? And then all of a sudden, when you want there to be carbohydrates, you got to somehow introduce it. How did that happen on an early Earth? Nobody knows. And then the amino acids, half of them have a stereogenic or chiral center. And so, 19 of the 20 have a stereogenic or chiral center. How do you control those? Nobody knows. And about half of them have what's called an active side chain, meaning that they can hook up in a wrong order, in a wrong way to attach. So half of them are having this wrong attachment system. So it's very hard, and you have to have these enzymes that construct us. And that's why we might eat a bagel for breakfast this morning, and by lunchtime, that bagel has been broken up into pieces and is part of one of the cells in our ear, for example. How did that happen? It's because enzymes, these protein-based systems, most enzymes are proteins made up of these polypeptides, and they are the little machines that will build us, that will construct us, will take molecules and set them in certain places. And so you have to be able to have these and have these right. We have no idea how these things form. And plus, they have a code. They have an order that they have to be in order to be able to carry out the function that they need. It's not just a random sequence. It's a very specific sequence, which causes it to fold in a very specific manner that has an active site where that analyte molecule can go into and react with it. And then there's many enzymes that need coenzymes that by themselves, they don't work alone. They have to work in concert with other proteins and form dimers or trimers or tetramers, like hemoglobin is a tetramer. And then other times they have to work with coenzymes, other small molecules that have to work in conjunction with them. And so to get these things to work, they need a lot of infrastructure around them. Nobody knows how all this came together. And remember, you can't have two lines of evolution going on, two lines of chemical changes going on in molecules that are disparate in the earth. These coenzymes have to be right there in place with the enzymes. And remember, these enzymes aren't going to last long. If you happen to have, just by randomness, if an enzyme happened to form, how does it fold up into the structure it needs to? Most of these are need what are called chaperones, other enzymes to help them to fold properly. So in other words, if you have a if you have a hammock, and you say these hammocks that are made out of rope, how do you think that rope can fold into that hammock structure just by itself? No, somebody had to weave that rope into the hammock so that it's a hammock. You can't just leave it out in the wind and the rain and expect it's going to fold into this structure of a hammock. It doesn't do it. And you say, well, I'm taking a hard example. That folded structure in the hammock is really hard to do. No, the enzymes are harder. The enzymes have more combinations that they can go through. And so each one of these enzymes has to have a chaperone, another molecule that helps it to fold and to orient. So if you don't have the folded structure right, you just have a rope. You don't have a hammock. It had to have been tied properly with these in this ordered arrangement in order to have that rope now be a hammock. This is the same type of things that happens with these polypeptides. It has to now be able to fold into this structure in order to be usable. How does this happen? Nobody knows. And if you just say it folded by randomness, if it were just 100 amino acids long, there's not enough time in the universe, in the 14 billion years predicted for or estimated for there to be a universe, there's not enough time for that to have randomly tried the combinations to fold right. It would still be thrashing about today. But plus, it only remains in water for a matter of days. And then it starts falling apart. And so that's one problem on top of another problem.
So we got probability is a huge problem here. You just walked us through how the Miller-Urey experiment is presented, even in much modern literature, as this success story of, oh, we've created life. But you've actually showed us how this is actually a real challenge, and you have to get things in the right order. All right, so let's just say that with all of those challenges, what if we have fully functioning amino acids set, and maybe they're somewhere out in the distant reaches of the universe, and a meteorite then delivers those fully functional amino acids to us? How does that work?
Yeah, so you have to get 20 amino acids, not just one. And they all come as mixtures, and they all come mixed with many, many other molecules. And so they generally don't stay around. And you have these amino acids, if they happen to be around a carbohydrate, they don't stick around. They form these Millard reactions that I just mentioned. Now, let's say all 20 amino acids were delivered here on a meteorite. Now what? They don't want to hook together. Again, the free energy is positive. They'd rather be apart than together. So there's no mechanism to get them together. Now, you might say, well, I'm going to use a wet-dry cycle. Yeah, they've made 14 MERS, but they were never able to deal with that pendant group, which can also interfere. So you can't deal with the pendant groups. And so they have to find a lot of other support molecules to be able to them to have clever coupling chemistry to be able to work. It's very difficult to envision that, very difficult to deal with this, especially if they have a side chain that bears an amine or a side chain that bears a carboxylic acid. These totally interfere and they'd become useless. So there's no way to solve these things. And Origin of Life people can't gloss over this with me. YouTubers gloss over this with me because they don't understand the inherent problem. But no Origin of Life researcher will engage with me to discuss these problems because they know it's unsolvable. They know it's unsolvable. So that they will not engage with me, that they will refuse to have these public discussions with me, is telling in itself. That's what I'm talking about. They will not have these discussions because they're organic chemists. They see exactly what I see. It's not that Jim Tour sees these problems and nobody else does. Everybody working in the community sees these problems, but they don't talk about it. That's the problem.
That's a huge problem. And then you've got those on the outer edge who know just enough to be dangerous, but don't fully understand the complexity. And they say, well, surely it's possible. We'll figure it out. Dr. Tour, you talked about probability being a huge issue here. I've got one more question when it comes to proteins. Talk a little bit about the you call it a chicken and egg, basically, paradox of proteins needing enzymes to form.
Right. So all proteins to form, the majority, not all, but the majority of proteins, certainly that are going to be sophisticated enzymes, need other chaperones, other enzymes that are going to help them to fold. Well, who caused the chaperone to fold? Another chaperone. Well, where did that chaperone come from? It had to have had another shot. So we don't know where these things, so we don't know where this inherent information came from for these to be able to form and fold. So all of that is an unknown. That's the chicken and egg problem. It's not been solved. And everybody who works in this area knows it's not been solved, but they don't bring it up.
That's incredible. You know, even a toolkit of working proteins can't function out in the open. It needs a protected, organized workspace that will then separate inside from outside, maintain the gradients in the right order, control traffic. And that, I guess, brings us to lipids. So we're talking about the foundation of the cell membrane forming a bilayer that separates the inside of a cell from its environment. And it's not really just like a passive wall, as I understand. It's a dynamic platform where other crucial molecules can integrate. And then proteins embed within the lipid bilayer to act as channels and pumps and receptors and basically allow the cell to control nutrient flow, waste removal, and even the signaling of a lot of that. And then carbohydrates attach to lipids and proteins on the surface, creating recognition sites that allows for communication. It also helps protect them. But what I'm saying is that lipids provide this structural framework that makes cellular life possible. But it works hand in hand with all of the other things that we've talked about so far. So, Dr. Tour, why are they considered the essential building blocks for life?
Well, let me first say, I'm impressed. I mean, you learned all of what you just said, which is really impressive. Most people don't know this, that if you're going to have a functioning lipid bilayer, you have to have them hooked up to carbohydrates, which provide recognition. There are also other proteins that are hanging off that provide recognition sites. And then you have protein channels, these transmembrane proteins, which are needed to have respiration. And then you also have other carbohydrate type structures within the lipid bilayer that act as ionophores, that act as mechanisms by which ions can flow in and out to keep the gradients, these transmembrane gradients operating. The lipids, in order to make lipids, you have to take a fatty acid, which are not that easy to make. Some people say they come out of hydrothermal vents. I'm not sure that on prebiotic Earth you had these things coming out of a hydrothermal vent, but even if you did, they've got to somehow react with glycerol, which is 1,2,3 propane triol. And they have to be able to distinguish the two ends, which are identical, except to another chiral compound. And without enzymes being around, how do you pick out one and not the other? They're enantiotopic. It's not known. And then you have the two position being reacted as well. And these are esters. And so they want to hydrolyze. Esters hydrolyze in water. They don't want to form. Again, this is another positive delta G problem. So you have to somehow catalyze this, heat it up, and draw the water out as these are forming. You have to do something to push this reaction forward. They don't normally form, and they'll want to hydrolyze and go back. And then they've got to get in this bilayer structure, which can happen under shear. But just having a lipid bilayer structure, which is called a liposome, doesn't do it for you. You have to have the interaction with the proteins, which we said couldn't be made, and with the polysaccharides, which we said couldn't be made. So that's the problem with lipids. And many of the lipids actually have an extra stereogenic center somewhere along that hydrocarbon chain.
Okay. So we actually talked about, and I won't go too much in the weeds here, but we've talked about chirality in different areas so far. Does that play a part in lipids as well?
Absolutely. That's what I'm talking about. There are not enantiotopic ends to the glycerol, and that is all a chirality issue.
Interesting. Okay. We've got so much more to cover, and I don't want to go too long here. So what I'm going to say is, we've got basically components on the table, but now we need to shift our question from what life is made of to how actually the instructions for life are put together. Basically, move from raw chemistry to now an extremely specified sequence, even though everything that you've talked about so far is highly ordered, it appears, but something that could be read and used. So let's talk about fact three. Let's talk about DNA for a moment. Prebiotic forces can't arrange DNA nucleobases that contain the stored information of the DNA strand. So even if we've got a fully functioning strand of DNA or RNA, we've got carbohydrates, proteins, and a lipid bilayer, you still have to have this stored information to direct functions, right? To tell it what to do in the DNA code. And I'm talking about basically nucleotide bases, adenine, thymine, cytosine, guanine, in an extremely simplified fashion. It's like the blueprints, the recipe book for life. And those letters are pairing up to form chains. You mentioned a little while ago that a group of three of those letters, codons, basically can act like words that will tell the cell what to do. You put all of that in the right order, and somehow it all comes together. But that information has to be ordered. It's almost like a computer code. And then you think of the complexity of some of this, where the direction of protein development in human DNA, I think it's about 3 billion base pairs. But even the simplest cell, we're talking about thousands or hundreds of thousands, right?
Oh, yeah. Millions of base pairs. Yeah, and the simplest ones, yeah, hundreds of thousands. So that's a real problem. So you said if you already have your DNA and RNA, If you already have your DNA and RNA, where'd the code come from? It's just a string of letters that are going to code for nothing useful. They code for nothing useful. So you had to have had information put in before you can have any useful DNA and RNA. Now, you start with the nucleotides, and you have to polymerize the nucleotides together. Nobody knows how these go together because, again, the free energy is positive, which means these do not want to go. So you have to have some other clever methods where these can hook up. And they don't hook up cleanly. You get branching. They get, in the case of RNA, they get this 2'5' linkage. In the case of RNA, they need a separate base. You exclude one of the bases on the DNA. You have to bring in uracil on the RNA, so it needs a separate base. The DNA can't make any doesn't make proteins directly. It has to go through first templating to RNA to get RNA made. And then from the RNA, generally, you get the proteins. That's the normal sequence that we look at. And you need lots of support enzymes. So you need enzymes to string these things together. You need a code to string these things together. Nobody knows where that came from. You need enzyme support for any one of these, DNA to be useful to make RNA, for RNA to be useful to make proteins. You need other support enzymes that bring in all the individual amino acids when you need them into place in order for this to happen. None of that is known. None of that is known how that happened on a prebiotic Earth. We are utterly lost on that when it comes to the origin of life.
See, this is something that I think our audiences need to know. The public needs to know these issues that are being faced that are not being talked about. I mean, Dr. Tour, you've been talking about them for a while, but very few people have tried to even mention the unspeakable of we don't know on this origin of life issue how it could have happened by itself. But every time that we're talking to someone, I always like to relate it to something that we can understand. Like, I mean, let's just talk about a written code, right? A book or something like that. How does DNA's code resemble a written work, like a book?
Oh yeah, and it's much longer than a book. I mean, it prescribes what RNA is going to be made, and then the RNA prescribes what the order of attachment is of those 20 amino acids to make the proteins. And it's that order of attachment that is going to define the function of that protein. Is that protein going to be used to make more RNA, or is that protein going to be used to break down the carbohydrates that you've just eaten so that that energy can then be applied as glycogen in your body so that you can get energy from it. Enzymes do all of these functions, and the functions are defined by the order of the amino acids in it. So if you don't have the inherent order in the RNA, which came from the inherent order within the DNA, you're out of luck. I mean, it's just not going to do anything. It's just going to be a bunch of gibberish.
Well, you know, I would probably laugh at someone who handed me even a simplistic book or an article even and said, you know, that created itself. Books don't write themselves. So what do you say to students who believe that DNA could just have evolved its information?
Yeah, that makes no sense. Only an idiot would say that. That's what I have to say. It makes absolutely no sense. It's really nonsense to say that DNA could inherently form with a functioning code. Things don't happen like that any more than you can take a random box of letters, shake it together, dump it on the ground, and have a written book. You might occasionally find a three-letter word. On occasion, you might find that. But it's not next then to another intelligible word where you're going to form a book out of this thing. And remember, even if you had three or four words in a string that happened to form, it's not going to make any sense. There's nothing on either side of that. You need lots of information. So nobody in the right mind even says this except people who know nothing about the field.
That makes perfect sense. On an intellectual level, we have to consider that. Put simply, just having the right pieces is not ever going to create a living system. It's always purposeful order. I mean, you can line up bolts or gears or wires or anything without an intentional plan, nothing's going to run. And that's the tension that we keep finding the deeper that we look at this issue. We've got one more part to this issue, this Age of Design series. And I really want this to be a wrap up of everything that we've learned so far. So if you could spend a moment and talk about the issue of the origin of life.
Okay, so the issue here is that we need four classes of compounds, which we don't know how to make. And we don't even know how to make the small molecules that make up those four classes of compounds if we restrict ourselves to what would have been available on an early Earth. Inherent within each one of those classes of compounds is a code, is in an informational code. DNA has a code based on its order. RNA has a code based on its order, which it normally gets from DNA. Then when it transcribes that information into a protein, the protein has that informational code. And then when those proteins make other molecules like the polysaccharides, those polysaccharides bear a code. And in fact, you can store more information in a polysaccharide than you can even in DNA. And so it can get information from the outside in these ways. So it's just an information problem as well. And then enzymes also are used to build the lipids. And now when lipids form within a lipid bilayer in a cell, there's an ordering of those lipids. In other words, you get domains of structure. It's not all the same all the way around. You get domains of structure, and those domains are constantly moving over the surface of that cell. There's a moving on the interior, and there's a moving moving on the exterior, moving on the interior as well. And that also is a bearer of information, and they change throughout the life of the cell. It's a huge information system. Nobody knows where the inherent information came from. Now, what you have to do is you have to have these working together in concert. And so all of these have to work in coordination with one another. And so there's a huge assembly problem. How do you have a train doesn't work. I mean, you have to have lots of trains working together, and they need to know when to start, when to stop, when to go, when to stop, or else there's massive accidents if the trains are not coordinated. This is happening multi-scale within a cell. All of this has to happen. It has to happen at the right time. You have to have the right molecules being made at the right time. For molecules for things to form in a cell, you have to have the right enzymes being made at that particular time for the function that the cell needs. And then those enzymes get broken back down into amino acids and turned into other enzymes that are needed for the cell for that construction. And so it's a huge factory going into a cell. So everything we've covered so far has just been the individual entities. We couldn't get that in Origin of Life. We have no idea how these start coordinating with one another. There's a lot of traffic cops that go from the non-coding DNA, the non-coding parts of the DNA, which is called the intergenic DNA, which they used to be called junk DNA, but they're no longer called junk because these are the things that are the regulation sites that tell us when to turn things on. These are the traffic cops, when to turn it on and when to turn it off in the cell so that you can have the right things at the right time. This is just even in a single cell. And all of this is needed for the origin of life. Now, why would researchers not talk about this type of thing? Why do they keep publishing papers that say we're on the verge of where they overblow this, and then it gets to the press to say we're on the verge of solving this origin of life problem? Or why do the textbooks, even to the graduate level, say that life came out of a primordial soup pond where none of the models work? That is more of a philosophical issue. Why do researchers do this? Is it because they want to keep their money flowing, or is it because they have totally deceived themselves with their own work, and then when they're challenged on it, they have no answer? So one of the things that's telling is that none of them will challenge me in a conversation on these points. They don't even want to have a discussion, a public discussion with me based on these points, because there is no answer to any of this. And in their heart of hearts, they know how far they are from being able to solve these things, because the target gets further away every year that we understand the more complexity in a cell that has to be there. And it's not like you can say, well, back the earliest of cells were extremely simple. We already know what the earliest cells look like, first of all, because we can find them in the fossil record, and they're about the same complexity as our simplest cells today, number one. Number two, biophysicists have already calculated how simple a cell could be to still be useful. You can back calculate what functions can you get rid of. And if you go back to a cell that could never survive on its own because it has to get all the exogenous amino acids from the outside, even with that, even with the simplest of cells, it has to have about 15 higher order structures. In other words, structures that are made out of these four different components. And of these 15 higher order structures, none of them have been made in any origin of life scenario. And then once you have all of them, you can't just throw them on the inside of a lipid bilayer and expect them to work any more than you could take all the parts of the engine in your car, take it apart into all its individual parts and throw that all into the driver's seat and shut the door and say, well, if I shake this up enough, the engine will reform. It doesn't. All of these have to have a specific order to them. And these are the non-covalent interactions. And there's astronomical numbers that have to be solved in order to get this thing to be solved, so much so that it could never form in the lifetime of billions and billions and billions of universes. All of these are problems that have to be solved. So again, it's this philosophical problem as to why am I the only one or a few people saying these problems that know this in this area? And one of the reasons is because the scientific establishment itself makes it hard on people that oppose the status quo. If you're going to oppose the status quo, if you're a young assistant professor, it could cost you your job. It's hard to get your papers published if you try to publish papers that oppose the status quo. It could make it very hard to get funding. And what happens is the community starts coming against you. And then the community does what it can do to keep you from getting certain grant money, so you can't continue your field. And then there's other people like YouTubers that come against you on YouTube that will call you liars, that will call you different things, so that it makes your life a little bit less enjoyable in that sense. So who wants to get involved in such a thing? Why even open your mouth? Why not just let it go? And that's where many people have said, why even fight this thing? So that's kind of synopsis from small molecule all the way to the philosophical endpoint.
And you've mentioned multiple times trains and these traffic engineering principles. So let's get philosophical for just a second. Do you think that this type of engineering that we've seen, that you've described so far, do you personally think that could have been created by chance, or do you think there's design involved?
Well, we already know from the calculations that have been done, we already know it could not happen by chance. It could not have happened by chance. So whenever I present the science, I do not use the intelligent design or God of the gaps argument, because there's enough science that screams out your little models don't work. But if the randomness of chance is off the table, then there's going to have to be something else. Then you have to put on the table, well, maybe there was an intelligent designer. You'd have to put that on the table. Or you could say that we are too far from the target. In 1,000 years, we might have more understanding that would allow us to understand how these things could have happened. And the reason I say that is this. If you asked a man or a woman in the year 1700, will we ever be able to put people on the moon and bring them back again? They would have had no context for this. They would have said, we can't even fly, let alone space flight, let alone all the way to the moon. I mean, it would have made no sense to them. They could not have fathomed how in 300 or 400 years you would get space flight and put people on the moon. The whole interconnectivity of being able to speak over an internet. Nothing, none of this would have had context. That's why as a scientist, I cannot say that it absolutely therefore had to have come from an intelligent designer. All I can say is that right now it is the only other thing that we can put on the table, but I don't know what the world is going to know in 500 or 1,000 years. That's all I can say. That's as far as I can go on it.
Well, scientific research has revealed an incredible complexity and order to everything within a biological world, which I believe is leading us towards a conclusion that you are designed. That's what we want to leave you with through this whole Age of Design series that we've been doing. Dr. Tour, thank you so much for visiting with us today. Do you have any last comment that you want to share?
Well, I just want to share that I am not the only one that sees this. There are many others that see it, but they don't want to speak up because of the ramifications from the community of speaking up like this. But again, what I am seeing, what I see is that we're nowhere close to solving this problem. It is an amazing design system, so much so that even biologists now are using that word designed. It is not just restricted to Christians using that word. It is biologists themselves that they'll say there is this appearance of design. It is looking like design. There's so many things that have to be coordinated for a biological system to work that they're seeing it, but they're very careful to couch this. They don't know where that design came from, but they're talking about it. So little by little, I think actually this whole area of origin of life is going to come crashing down within a couple of decades. It's just going to be exposed for what it is, for the scam. It really is a scam for what it is. But I'll close with that.
If you had any piece of advice that you would give to a young biologist, a young chemist who is currently going through university, who is faced with this type of a challenge, to embolden them to look towards real science and not be held back by antiquated theories, what would you tell them right now?
I would say don't just do the same thing that Origin of Life researchers are doing. Think of some new approach where you take, for example, a cell and you, like Craig Venter has been doing, taking pieces out of it and seeing what's needed to get it to operate. That's a much closer thing to do. And the other thing that I would encourage you to do is that if you have not seen the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ, if you've not seen that, you can send me an email to tour@drjamestour.org, and we'll get together and I'll share with you. But this is just for people who do not believe in the physical resurrection of Jesus Christ, and I'll show you some of that evidence. And I think after an hour, you'll come out believing that, because there we have strong evidence that that man rose from the dead. And the other thing I'll say is I do have a YouTube channel, Dr. James Tour, and it's Instagram and Facebook and on all of these different platforms where you can hear a lot more with a lot more detail of the problems of origin of life and then also details about more about the resurrection of Jesus Christ.
I love that. Thank you for sharing that. Okay, so we can go to Dr. James Tour, drjamestour.org. We can find you on YouTube. We can find you on a lot of the other socials. And I would encourage our audience, go check this out. It is important information, and I believe that it's pointing us to a much bigger picture, an incredible picture of this design that you are designed. Dr. Tour, thank you so much for joining us today. For all of you who wish to seek the truth, please follow Dr. Tour. Visit us at ageofdesign.org. Check out YouTube's, all of our social medias as well, and share this with your friend. That is it for today, and I want to thank you for joining us on the Genesis Science Report. Until next week, I want to remind you to keep looking up. I'm David Reeves. Truly, the heavens declare the glory of God.
Thank you for joining me today. If you could give us a like, share, or podcast review, we would appreciate it. If you have any questions, you could send them to ask@jesusandscience.org, and we'll try to answer some of those questions in an upcoming video. And if you do not believe in the physical resurrection of Jesus Christ, and you want to hear about why I believe, send me an email to tour at
drjamestour.org, and we'll get together by Zoom, and I'll share with you why I embrace the resurrection of Jesus Christ.